We're in for a long show tonight, are we not?
I don't, honestly, I don't know how long the FBI thing's going to last.
I hope you put that on the pre-show. Marco's classic. Honestly, I don't think there's much to say. Always says that.
I never say it's going to be a short show, though. That's always you.
But that you say it in a different way. That's the way you say it. Can you tell I have a cold? My streak is over. I thought I was going to go two whole winters without getting sick. Almost made it out of this one. So close.
Can we just drive you over to Craig's house and you can fix your cold? I recognize that wasn't the best use of that metaphor, but I just cannot get tired of that metaphor. It's so good.
Yeah, it's kind of mean, though. Like, this gets back to what I was saying on the past show when we were talking about the new Open Applin coming on podcast or whatever. It's so easy to make fun of that. But that type of story is an example of people opening up. Like, it's the type of thing that in a more controlled PR environment would never come out. And it's slightly unfortunate that that's the story that they put out there, because even on the merits, it's kind of like, well, you're trying to make an emotional appeal, but realistically speaking, that's not an effective way for an organization to address problems, to have the head of the, you know, the head honchos of these huge swaths of the biggest company in the world be addressing problems on an individual level with their own particular Macs. Like, that's not, you need better tools to manage this problem. So it just seems like you're trying to sway me emotionally with this anecdote, but it doesn't even make sense. But that's the type of thing that you do when you open up about yourself and your personal life. And I'm sure it really is true. And so I'm glad we know that that's what's going on. And now we can, I guess, make our own judgments about the effectiveness of the strategy of driving things to Craig Federighi's house. I don't know. It's also trying to say how passionate they are, that even these big, important people are not above getting down to a problem that they encounter, that they're not going to leave it to the lower people and say, oh, they'll take care of that, that they really want to fix every little problem they found. So it's multifaceted, it's personal, it's human, it's flawed. It's everything that the new Open Apple, the new more Open Apple, is about.
So I only have a few questions about it. First of all, in what part of a Ferrari does an iMac fit?
They have a lot of cars. If you have a, here's the rule of thumb. If you have a Ferrari, it is not your only car.
That's fair. Okay. Second question. Can you imagine being Federighi and basically being like the tech support team for the entire company?
I wonder if that's like a power move. Like, do you have something wrong with Apple Music? Do you like drive your computer over to Eddie's house?
Well, see, that's, I feel like it's unfair because all of Eddie's stuff is all cloud and services. Like, you can't really drive a broken iTunes store request over to Eddie's house.
Well, you just bring your computer and say, why is all my album metadata messed up? Fix this. And you come back on Monday and you say, is it done? Did you fix my album metadata?
I think it's even funnier to imagine, like, you know, you're Craig Federighi, you're like sitting down at dinner with your family, and you know, you hear this like loud, you know, V12 pull up in the driveway, you're like, oh God, again. Oh, it's Eddie again. Hold on, everyone.
Does he have the 599?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if Ferrari's well enough to even. I was just guessing there was probably a V12 one.
There is.
Is there only one?
Was only one. Well, there's the FF. Is that a V12? Casey, do you remember?
I thought so, but I too am not an encyclopedia of Ferrari.
There's two front engine V12s, I think. One of them's really ugly and four wheel drive.
That's the FF.
Yeah.
Is that even a Ferrari?
It really is.
If it's ugly and four wheel drive,
it still is.
John would suffer through.
Oh, I wouldn't. If I got that, I would sell it immediately and buy a better one.
Oh, man. Anyway, we should probably do some follow-up, shouldn't we? Tell me about Figma, which I don't even remember talking about.
It was that vector thing. Remember that app that was going to let you draw vectors in a different way? And I said on the website, basically, they had a big sign-up button instead of a big download button. So I was like, oh, there's nothing to download if you know... Like, you can sign up, and I guess they'll tell you more when it's ready. Like, as in, the thing wasn't out yet. And David Klein tweeted to say that he's, I believe Figma is 100% in the browser, nothing to download. So, when it does arrive, apparently it's going to be a web app. But I still think you can't yet try it. But anyway, if I can try it for free online, I definitely will, because I'm interested in how it's going to work.
Fair enough. That was quick and easy. And why don't you tell us about everyone's favorite font, Comic Sans?
Yes. friend of the show, and... Flophouse adjacent micro celebrity John McCoy, and a friend of mine, pointed out that in all our discussion of Comic Sans, or Microsoft Bob rather, we didn't mention that Comic Sans, the much hated font, was created for, but not shipped with Microsoft Bob. So you can read the Wikipedia entry on Comic Sans, and you will see that it was created to try to fit in with the Microsoft Bob world, which explains why it's so awful. But it didn't. It didn't make it in time, so it didn't ship with it. So yet another thing you can blame on Microsoft Bob.
Have you ever used Microsoft Bob, John?
I don't think so. I think I've read about it in magazines when it came out, but I didn't have a PC, obviously, and none of my friends who had a PC had it.
All right, John, stop listening for a second. Casey, we have to, for April Fool's Day, somehow find a way to put Microsoft Bob on a computer in John's office.
I don't remember using it. I bet you I did at some point, but I don't remember having done so.
I installed Windows 8 on a VM on my Mac, and that felt really weird.
Well, to be fair, Windows 8 felt really weird to Windows users also.
I know. You ever try like doing an edge swipe with a mouse cursor on a windowed VM? It's really hard.
Wow.
Again, in all fairness, doing everything in Windows 8 is really hard.
Well, just remember that was my life, boys, until just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations again for getting out of that.
Thank you. I'm so happy. I really am. Anyway, we are done with follow-up, are we not?
That's it.
Was that just two small items?
Wow, look at us go. Let's celebrate by talking about something awesome.
All right, our first sponsor this week is Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Now look, everybody, I know you know how to make websites. I know how to make websites. I know how to make things without using Squarespace. But I usually don't anymore because it's just not worth it. Because Squarespace gives you so much functionality and great themes, great templates, great support. There's so much they give you at Squarespace that it just simply isn't worth making websites any other way most of the time. Simple as that. You know, I'm not going to tell you there's never a reason to not use Squarespace, but I will tell you that most of the time, just using Squarespace will save you a ton of time. And if you're making a website for other people, it's even more compelling because then other people can help themselves with their website. They don't have to come to you every time they want to change, you know, whatever's in the sidebar or whatever. If they need tech support for the website that you ostensibly built for them, they don't have to ask you. They can ask Squarespace. So if you're making a website for yourself, huge time savings. If you're making a website for somebody else, you basically cut yourself out of the picture immediately, and then you can go on with your life and not be involved and not be constantly on the hook for tech support for other people. It's amazing. So check it out today. There is tons of functionality in Squarespace. You can build stores. You can build, you know, portfolios, galleries, even simple things like blogs. You can build podcasts. Our podcast site is hosted there for this show, as well as many other podcasts I know of. Squarespace is great for hosting so many kinds of websites, and it saves you so much time and hassle from trying to do things any other way before. So check it out today. You can do a free trial with no credit card required. You can just really do a free trial. Start making any website you want today on Squarespace and see how far you get in like an hour or two. I bet you'll find that it is way easier and way faster than any other solution you've ever done before. And then you're just done. Then you can move on and do anything else with your time besides making websites. Because honestly, I don't enjoy making websites. So Squarespace is great because I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time doing it. They take care of everything for me. It's so easy. It's so great. You can do so much with so little effort. Check it out today. Squarespace.com. Get your free trial started right now. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Thanks a lot to Squarespace for sponsoring our show.
So there's been big breaking news that has happened since we recorded last. And I think it's important we talk about it. Microsoft has bought Xamarin.
I'm sorry. I just, yeah. That news is fine. I really appreciated your intro there.
I didn't think much about Xamarin, but if you had asked me, hey, does some company own Xamarin now? I would have maybe guessed Microsoft. I know, like, didn't NetWare own them at some point?
Something like that, yeah.
But I had lost track of who owned them, and they've been so closely associated with Microsoft that if you had told me, oh, yeah, no, Microsoft owns Xamarin, I would have been like, oh, yeah, that sounds right. So the fact that Microsoft bought them makes sense to me, I think.
Yeah, so let me catch everyone up. So Xamarin was originally called Mono, and it was an open source reimplementation of .NET that was designed to bring .NET to other platforms. And initially, this really meant Linux, but over time, it became more about allowing you to write .NET code, usually C# code, that ran on Android and iOS. And I looked at it way back when it was Mono 1, or I'm sorry, it was a long time ago, right when they first started supporting the iPhone. I forget what version that was. And as we've talked about a handful of times on the show, it felt like exactly how I would have written a bridging platform to go between the world of C# and iOS. That's a compliment. It felt really, really good. Now it's still a total hack, but it felt like it was really well designed and really, really well done. And so Microsoft has since bought Xamarin, which again used to be called Mono. So now it's being folded into Microsoft. And this is kind of an extension of what they did a year or so, maybe 2 years ago, when they open sourced a lot of the .NET framework. So in part, see that Xamarin and other people like them could use Microsoft code in order to get the bits of .NET they needed. And then Xamarin could go back to doing the thing they were good at, which was just building that like cross-platform layer. So Microsoft is buying Xamarin. We'll see what that means. This reminds me of our conversations in the past about Project Islandwood, which was/is, I haven't really kept up with it, a cross-platform setup that Microsoft had to bring iOS apps onto Windows 10. I think that's mostly died. Is that true?
Was it ever alive? I mean, like, I know they released that in some form, and I know people looked at the code and it was horrendous and full of tons of like temporary hacks and like to-do implementations and everything. And
well, because wasn't it like a re-implementation of UIKit and on top?
That was the idea, and I remember didn't it come out like right after Swift was announced, and is not compatible with Swift at all, and so there was that issue. And then the other issue is, yeah, like they basically, it tries to be a layer so that you can write, basically you can port your iOS app right over to Windows Phone or Windows in general. I don't know which version of Windows, but right over to Windows something or other, and it would just re-implement, you know, all the basic iOS frameworks. And I honestly have not heard of anybody using it for any reason. I mean, the reason why iOS developers are not making their apps for Windows is not because we can't cross-compile them. It's because we don't care, because there's not enough of a market. Literally. I mean, like, I'm not trying to be mean. It's like, if we wanted to make apps for those platforms, we would just make them correctly, you know, using their native tools and their native apps. The fact that there is this weird half-compatibility layer that is kind of half baked and kind of half works and is probably only half supported by anybody, that's not really going to change anyone's mind meaningfully. You know, that might help out a couple of consultants on really tight time constraints, but even then, like, are the clients even asking for Windows apps? Like, there just seems like there is so little demand and will for people to make Windows apps. This is not going to meaningfully change that.
You know, if this was the 90s, the old story was like, don't bother trying to make a Linux-compatible implementation of the Common Language Runtime or .NET, because you're just playing into Microsoft's trap. And even though Microsoft says all these things about, oh, you know, cross-platform runtime virtual machine environment, C#, blah, 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 really what they're just trying to do is trap you. So that's why the Linux community always kind of looked at them, you know, with a little bit warily, saying, I don't really want to make any Linux apps using this Microsoft technology. No, it's not a Microsoft technology. It's totally open. It'll be just like, I don't know about that. And if we were still in the 90s and Microsoft was still that company that everyone was scared of and everyone suspected they were going to, you know, embrace, extend, extinguish all this other stuff, what everyone would be saying was, see, we were really smart not to try to build anything in Linux based on the Common Language Runtime or .NET, because if we did, now Microsoft bought them, and guess what? All that cross-platform stuff that they were doing before, well, that's all over now, and everything that is in Xamarin is going to become Windows only, and nothing's going to be cross-platform anymore, because, you know, it was just like, it was a trap, basically. Get people to distract Linux, which was a big threat to Microsoft in their own mind back in the 90s, and to use Microsoft technologies, and then take those technologies away and make them proprietary from that point on. But, of course, the modern Microsoft buying Xamarin for exactly the opposite reasons, because they're a company that has shown that they're good at doing things cross-platform, and the new Microsoft wants to sell whatever it is they have to sell to as many people as possible. And they're moving away from, the only way to get this is to get it on Windows. You know, Azure Web Services are an example of courting iOS developers and stuff. You can use these web services with your iOS app. They'll sell anything to anyone because they think they have valuable things, and they're no longer in a position where they can say, we have valuable technology, and the only way you can get it is to be Microsoft and Windows and proprietary from top to bottom, because nobody does that anymore. It's not even an option. So I think this purchase of Xamarin would have blown the minds of like Linux advocates in the 90s, the idea that they're buying them because they're so good at cross-platform stuff, and that surely what they're going to do with those people and that technology is more cross-platform things, not like, oh, now finally we can stop people from using our technology to do anything except for make apps for our platform.
So here's a question. I don't, you know, I haven't looked too much into this, so forgive me, but you know, back in the 90s when Sun Microsystems made this really, really expensive custom proprietary hardware and software to run, you know, custom Sun boxes. And then Sun invented Java, and Java is seen by many as kind of a big strategic blunder by Sun, because the whole point of Java is to make proprietary platforms and hardware completely irrelevant and marginalize them and make the same software run everywhere. And so many people think that was Sun kind of eroding their own company's strong points and their own revenue sources. Trying to apply that today, I mean, do you like, what does Microsoft get big picture wise, long term wise? What do they get out of making Linux servers a first class platform for .NET development? Because right now, Microsoft makes a big portion of their revenue with Windows servers and Windows server side components and licensing from that. And, you know, how does that, obviously, like with Satya Nadella's new leadership focus more on services and enterprise stuff, it seems like this might be the opposite of what they wanted to do, right? Like, it seems like this is long term, removing them from being required to use their tools. So now, you know, like the server side stuff. Now, like before, one of the biggest reasons why people would buy Windows servers was not because they're particularly amazing, but because they had to run their .NET server stuff, because the .NET stuff was what they were comfortable developing in, or what they used already, or what was best for them for whatever reason. So Windows had a lot of, or Microsoft had a lot of server-side software sales from people who were kind of forced to use Windows Server, who might have chosen Linux if they could have. And with these, and there, you know, this the Mono project and then the Xamarin thing, like this is not new, but it's always kind of been like a second-class citizen. It was always kind of like, well, if you were the IT manager, you probably wouldn't choose that because you'd be scared of compatibility or whatever. So how does it help Microsoft now to have Linux be or become soon a first-class citizen to run their server-side stuff, which means nobody needs to buy Windows servers anymore?
Why does it help Apple to open source Swift? Or let me rephrase, why does it help Apple to make Swift compatible with Linux? That's a better question.
Well, I think, first of all, that Apple needs Swift on Linux because they need to run their own services on it. I think that's a big thing right now with Apple, is that their services are built on what is rumored to be a lot of web objects and old Java stuff, and just like old stuff that either is not maintained anymore, or is maintained only by Apple, or is not the right tool for the job, or is just in disrepair. And so I think Apple really wants Swift on Linux for themselves, for their own service division. With Microsoft, I don't know how much they need. I don't know. I don't know if that's why I'm asking. Like this is, I don't know if this is necessarily even a good question, but just like, is this a good idea for Microsoft long term to make Windows Server unnecessary?
Well, but they don't make their money off Windows Server as much as they make it off Exchange licenses and Office licenses and stuff. And they're like, Oracle is a great example. Oracle is an enterprise software company that makes tons and tons of money. And they don't force you to buy an operating system. I mean, they do have Oracle Enterprise Linux, right? But it's Linux, right? They don't sell hardware. They're just selling you their software, and it's qualified on certain pieces of hardware, and there's relationships with people who will sell you the hardware and what OS you should have or whatever. But it's when they want to sell you is an Exchange license for a certain number of people or whatever. And it's not as if doing this makes it more likely that there will be a successful Exchange competitor. Like Google's always tried to do it with Google Apps and everything, which is an entirely different approach and much more server side. But as far as Microsoft's concerned, you mentioned like Apple, like, oh, well, Apple has its own Linux server, so of course they want Swift on Linux. It's not unreasonable to imagine that Microsoft might decide, kind of like, I mean, you were talking about Sun before. One of the things that did Sun in was Linux, right? The idea that you can only run Exchange on a Windows server, it's crappy for kind of everyone, including Microsoft. Would Microsoft ever want to, you know, can you imagine a world where Microsoft sold you Exchange and Office, all of which ran on the Linux of your choice, but there's a couple that Microsoft recommends, including maybe a Microsoft variant of Linux? Sure, because if that means that Microsoft doesn't have to spend money maintaining a proprietary server OS that was never quite as good as Linux anyway, then that's a win. And that's sacrilege and like the Steve Ballmer thing. What are you talking about? Windows is the crown jewel and blah, blah, blah. But this is a brave new world here. And if you're really going to do services, you can't be tied to a particular server platform, especially when it's one that's like more difficult to manage. It has fewer companies behind it. I mean, Linux is basically raced across the entire server-side ecosystem, erasing every single proprietary competitor, so much so that former proprietary competitors say, okay, well, we'll just have our own variant of Linux, and everyone's okay with that. And it's just like, that's like, that part of the ecosystem has not been become the part where you make your money. In an enterprise, it's never been. You make your money off support contracts and licensing and charging per seat or per CPU or whatever the heck you do. You don't make it off selling them hardware boxes or OS licenses.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that enough. I remember being tangentially involved with pricing quotes for things like SharePoint and BizTalk and all of these big, big, big software packages that are not the server. These are the things you're installing on Windows Server. And I can't remember the details now, but oftentimes it was by processor. Then when multi-core processors became a thing, I think at some point some software might have been moved to a by-core installation cost. So if you have a 15-core computer, that doesn't make any sense, a 16-core computer with, you know, I don't know, four processors, then you're paying 16 times whatever the single amount is. Like, they make absurd amounts of money off of the software, just comically large amounts of money off the software. And to come back to one of your original questions, Marco, like, what is Microsoft in? What did they get out of this? I think what Microsoft gets out of this is it would be neat for them if writing C# was kind of the lingua franca of server-side programming. And obviously there will never be one language that's the standard language of server-side programming, but in the same way that Java is huge today, in part because it's open source, so much of .NET is going open source now that why couldn't .NET be the new Java in the future? And
because it's the old Java?
Well,
it's better than the old Java.
It's a lot better.
Has better support. You know what I mean? Like, especially now that Sun has been gobbled up and everything. Like, who is? I mean, I guess Java lurches forward, but if anyone was going to compete against Java as like Casey said, as the sort of default safe enterprisey server side language, it would be C#. And part of the thing that's been hurting Microsoft's story is, yeah, but then we got to buy Windows servers. And everyone knows that feeling. Like, especially if you have an organization that has all their other servers that are Linux-based and everyone's happy with them and they have an entire organization built up around managing those servers. They like the idea that they can buy different hardware from different vendors and change, you know, different distributions and everything like that. And then someone comes in and says, hey, you guys should use C# and write all your server-side stuff in C# using this server-side framework and this, that. And it's like, oh, but then we have to introduce Windows servers. Nobody wants that. Like, you can't really mix. It's almost like they keep those people separate. Like, you have one set of people who manage the Linux-based servers, and one set of people who manage the Windows-based servers. And I don't know if you bring those people into the same room that they will just collide and annihilate.
And I think the other thing we should say, a couple of quick notes. First of all, C# is a great language. It really, really is. I know there are going to be people out there who are rolling their eyes, but truly, C# is a wonderful, wonderful language that can be many, many, many different things to many, many, many different people. And I've been writing a lot of Swift over the last couple of weeks, and I'm really loving Swift, but C# is also a truly wonderful language and fixes many of the ills that Java brought to the table. And let's assume for a second that your firm or your staff is really into C#. Maybe they've never touched Microsoft servers, but they're really into C# and they think to themselves, man, I really want to go to the cloud with the C# instead of staying on-premise with Linux or on-premise with Microsoft. It doesn't matter. What cloud environment should we go to? We could just go to Azure, which probably will do very well with a C# based deployment. And even if Azure is Microsoft servers behind the scenes, who cares? Because you don't have to worry about it. So I think that there's plenty to gain from Microsoft by doing this, but we'll see what really ends up happening. Well, I don't know how much Xamarin specifically will make a difference, but the idea of Microsoft pushing to being everywhere or to having C# everywhere, I think is a good thing. John, any other last thoughts?
Yeah, one minor point. Speaking of both Oracle and Sun, yes, of course, Oracle was the company that bought Sun, which means that Oracle does actually sell hardware now, because Sun used to sell hardware, and now Oracle sells hardware through Sun, so they sell ZFS storage devices and stuff like that.
Ding.
Does that count?
Does that count? Yeah, does that count as a ding?
ZFS storage devices? There are file systems on them.
I don't think it counts, but that's a tough one.
All right, I rescind. I rescind my ding.
Our second sponsor this week is Fracture. Go to fracturemi.com to see for yourself and use code ATP10 for 10% off your first order. Fracture prints photos in vivid color directly onto glass. Now, colors pop like you won't believe, and it comes in a solid backing that's ready to mount right out of the package. All you have to do is stick the included screw on the wall and hang it up. Done. It's also very affordable, with prices starting at just $15 for their small square size and going up very reasonably from there. Fracture prints are great, and they make great gifts for family, friends, and loved ones, because they're already the perfect way to celebrate a shared memory with something that's also unique and modern, and they're really affordable, and they look really good. So check it out today. Go to fracturemi.com. Again, use code ATP10 for 10% off your first order there. I have fractures all over our house now. It started off in the office. They're now spreading to the rest of the house now. And everyone always compliments them. People love these things. They look great. These great photo prints right there on glass. These nice, thin, lightweight pieces of glass that, you know, it's not going to like fall off the wall with this giant heavy pane. It's a nice, thin piece of glass. And it sits there nice and flat against the wall. And it just looks modern and clean. You don't have to get it framed. You don't have to like try to flatten the paper within the frame against the glass. None of that stuff. Easy, simple. They look great. They're incredibly well-priced. Check it out today at fracturemi.com. Use code ATP10 for 10% off. Thanks a lot to Fracture for sponsoring our show.
Yeah, so there's been some interesting things going on with the United States government and Apple. And do we really need to recap this? I guess we probably should give the short version.
An overview would be helpful for people who listen in the future.
Yeah, although anyone listening to the story in real time, as we noted, this story came out right after we recorded last week. So presumably everyone listening to the show when it's released knows all these details, but we should summarize.
Does that mean I'm the one summarizing? I can take a crack at it real quick.
You do seem to be the chief summarizer on the show. Maybe John, you and John are close for that. I don't know.
Co-chief summarizers?
I'm certainly not, so I know I'm safe. I can sit back here and drink my tea.
All right, how about I'll take a stab at it here, and you guys can interrupt when you're ready. So there was a terrible, terrible, terrible shooting in December, I believe, of last year in San Bernardino, California. A couple of people took it upon themselves to commit this really heinous act and kill a lot of people. And that's really, really terrible. And there's no discussion about that. It's terrible. It was a terrorist act. It's something that's really unfortunate. These two people, suspects, perpetrators, whatever we'd like to call them, one of them, it was a husband-wife pair. The husband had two iPhones, as far as we know. One of them was destroyed. That was his personal phone. His wife's personal phone also destroyed. He also had an iPhone 5C that was issued to him by his job, which coincidentally is the San Bernardino government. The iPhone 5C has a passcode on it, and it is quite possible that it could be set up such that if you enter the passcode incorrectly 10 times in a row, it will nuke everything on the phone. The iPhone is in the custody of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. The FBI wants what's on that phone, but they can't get to it because it has this passcode. It could have the destruction setting turned on such that if they enter the wrong code 10 times, it will destroy itself or destroy all the data. Additionally, they were advised by Apple at some point or another, hey, we have iCloud backups. We don't have any from the last 6 or so weeks. I forget exactly how many. It doesn't really matter. We don't have a recent iCloud backup. We have a semi-recent one. And you know what you should do is you should take the phone and bring it to this guy's work, where presumably there is a known Wi-Fi network, and you should turn the phone on and just let it sit overnight. Plug it in, let it sit overnight. And presumably, if everything has been set the way it usually is set, that will back up, the phone will back itself up to iCloud one more time. And the implication from what we've read is that not everything in iCloud is as well encrypted as perhaps we'd like it to be. Thus, Apple could get to that data and hand it over to the FBI and everyone's happy.
I'm pretty sure from Apple's point of view, nothing in iCloud is encrypted. You can do the encrypted backups through iTunes on your desktop, and it's off by default. And so for a while, as we all learned, whenever we get a new phone or our phone would die, we have to get a replacement one. We have to re-enter all of our passwords. And the reason why is because anything that's encrypted on the device in the keychain, which is where all your passwords and stuff are stored, any unencrypted backup does not include those things. So by default, the iTunes backups wouldn't include them unless you check the little box saying encrypt my backup, which we all do because we are professional iPhone restorers, but not everyone knows that. And then with iCloud backups, there is no option to encrypt iCloud backups, at least not today. Maybe in the future there will be as a result of this. But
well, they are encrypted, but Apple has the key.
Well, right. So they aren't encrypted to Apple, you know. And so as a result, nothing that's encrypted on the phone in Keychain gets backed up. So, but almost everything, like any kind of like content, you know, text messages, I assume would be there. Any kind of, you know, app data that's marked as being for backup. So documents you've made in apps and everything, those would be included. And Apple has access to all of those. And Apple gave access to all of those to the FBI before this even blew up and became a thing, because Apple had access to them through iCloud.
But they only had an older backup, if several weeks old. It doesn't matter how many. So they advised the FBI and San Bernardino police, take the phone to the San Bernardino government, whatever particular branch this person was in, leave it on overnight, and it'll back itself up to iCloud. At which point, the police and FBI awkwardly grabbed at their collars, pulling them away from their necks, and said, about that. We might have changed his iCloud password already. So that phone is going to try to back up to iCloud, maybe, and it's going to see that it doesn't really have the right password. So that's not going to work. Right. So the FBI has decided to ask Apple for a few things. It would like Apple to write a custom build of iOS that, as far as the FBI is concerned, they are happy to be signed in such a way that it would only work on this particular device. It will allow them to, it will bypass the setting that will self-destruct the encryption after 10 failed passcode attempts, so they can attempt as many as they'd like. Additionally, they'd like any sort of time delay to go away, if there is one, and I forget exactly when those came in and when they're there and when they're not, but suffice to say, if there is a time delay, they'd like it to go away. And additionally, they'd like to be able to enter the passcode not by meaty fingers on a screen, but by Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or a cable or any way so that it can be automated with an external computer. The FBI has said we'd like to do it at our place, or Apple, if you'd prefer, we can do it at your house. That's fine, too. The end game for the FBI is they want to be able to throw a gazillion passcodes at this thing in a very short window of time to brute force their way into it. So that, by some measures, and we'll get into what we think here in a second, but some people are of the opinion that that's a perfectly reasonable point of view from the FBI, that they only want it for one phone. They only want to do it this once, and they're even willing to have Apple do it in Cupertino, in Apple's own environment, and the FBI will either come to them, or if Apple gives them like remote access to a machine that can enter passcodes, the FBI will do it remotely. They don't care. They just want it this one time for this one phone to see if possibly, maybe something on that will indicate that this was part of a wider terrorist plot rather than a couple of crazy people doing something that is really, really just uncool. That's the FBI's perspective. Apple's perspective is, hey, if we do this once, that's establishing a legal precedent. That means you can ask us to do this many, many more times. Not only that, but we would have to write code to do this. And that seems a bit unreasonable to tell us to write a bunch of code to allow you to brute force your way into a phone that we've spent a long time trying to make sure that isn't possible. Beyond that, a lot of government entities have come out of the woodwork over the last 48 hours saying, you know what? If this works for the FBI, we have a bunch of iPhones we'd like you to do that for too. Okay, cool. Sounds great. So Apple is of the opinion that this is a backdoor. And again, we'll get into what we think in a second, but Apple says this is a backdoor. And in fact, just earlier today, Tim Cook did a special with ABC News where he used the analogy that creating this is like creating a software version of cancer.
Which, by the way, I think a virus would be a better analogy there.
Didn't test as well.
Yeah, I thought he hammered that analogy a little too hard because it isn't that great of one.
He had a handful of talking points, and unfortunately, the interviewer had more than a handful of questions. So it was just like, after the first round, it was like, which one of my talking points am I going to use as a reply for this question?
Yeah, it was the same thing just over and over and over again, which is really too bad. But in any case, so Apple is of the opinion this is a backdoor. Once we've done this once, we're going to be asked to do it 1,000 times. We don't think it's fair to do it even once. We don't think it's fair to us. We don't think it's fair to our customers. We're not into it. So Apple is saying, we're not going to do it. And more than that, Tim Cook said in this interview, we are willing to go all the way to the Supreme Court fighting this because we think that's what's right. Is that a pretty reasonable summary of where we are today?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like, there's a lot more detail here that we could just by stating everything we have either learned or that's been talked about over the last week or so since this really broke. We could fill the whole hour and a half with this, and we shouldn't because it'll take too long. I think let's assume that everyone who wants to know more about this will go and read up on whatever is new and whatever has happened so far. And I think it's probably safe for us to talk about it now rather than just keep going over the details of it, right?
Good deal. All right, so what do we think?
It makes me sad. Every part of this makes me sad. There's so much of this that is just like crappy politics playing each other out, and mostly on the government side, honestly. I mean, listeners of this show should know that we do not shy away from criticizing Apple when it is warranted. We will call them out on things that we think are BS or things that we think are worse than they should be or are just not good enough. In this case, though, I think Apple is mostly in the right, and not 100% in the right, because and again, we should point out also, you know, none of us are lawyers, so you know, I apologize to anybody listening to this who knows more about the law than we do, who's screaming at whatever we don't mention or get wrong. But the one thing that I think makes this a weaker argument for them is that it is technically possible for them to do this. And I wonder in the future, you know, I assume it's already somebody's project at Apple, if it wasn't already. I assume it is now somebody's project at Apple to head an effort to actually make this impossible to do in the future, to remove their technical ability to do anything like this. And there are a number of ways that they could do that. There are a number of challenges to that. But ultimately, I think I mostly agree with Apple that I stand with them that they ideally shouldn't do this, but it does weaken their argument a little bit that they can do it.
When you say can do it, what you mean is, don't let me put words in your mouth, I'm just trying to make sure we're on the same page. What you mean is they could write a custom version of iOS that is specifically for this one and only one phone that would get the FBI what they're asking for.
I think. Now, first of all, it is definitely worth reading this article, and please forgive me for the pronunciation if I get it wrong, by Jonathan Ziarski. I don't know him, but he appears to be somebody who specializes in iOS forensics and like testifying in court using iOS forensic tools and creating forensic tools. And his post here kind of explains the legal implications of everything Apple kind of would have to do if they make this instrument the FBI is demanding that they make. I don't think the FBI is really asking for just this one phone to be decrypted once and that's it. I think they're asking for the continuous ability to do this, you know, whenever it is warranted or you know, whenever there is a court order or a warrant to do it. So and even if they aren't asking for that now, that's really what they're asking for. Like, you know, like even if they're not asking for that in the legal text, that is what will happen here because this will set precedent and then it'll be so much easier next time someone asks for this to be like, oh, well, you did it for that. This is just as important, you know. And I think Tim Cook covered that pretty well. Honestly, I think his interview on ABC News, I watched it right before the show tonight. I think his interview actually was very good overall. There were some parts that were a little bit uncomfortable and cringeworthy, but overall I think it was very good and I think he came off very well, and I think at a time like this this really shows the strength of Tim Cook and how we are lucky to have Tim Cook as the CEO of Apple during times like this.
I could not agree more.
This is like exactly like where he shines. Like he is clearly, and he's shown us in the past, but you know, this just, you know, shows more now. He's clearly very principled, and he won't be pushed around, you know, if it goes against his principles. And I think this just shows, I mean, you're not going to see any other company or any other executive put up the fight that he's going to put up on this. It's simple as that. I mean, like, you're not going to see anyone better than Tim fight this on that side of it. That, you know, again, I could nitpick a few little things he said, but overall, I thought it was very good. So honestly, I really do think that Apple is totally in the right to fight this. Only, again, only with that asterisk that it sure would be better if their actual answer was, we actually can't technically do this, it is impossible. Because then it's you can argue whether it should be legal to make things like that, but you can't argue about this case anymore. Then, because everyone's playing off everyone's emotions on this. And Tim did this too with his responses. He kind of had to, but like, you know, like the interviewer's like, well, think about the victims. And the FBI is all about, this isn't about our ability to decrypt phones forever. It's about these 14 families' victims. And yes, it is about them. And because this horrible event happened, this people were killed. There's nothing about that that is anything but horrible and a huge tragedy. But the FBI is also using this for their political gain. They knew that. They set this case up as a perfect fighting battleground to fight this issue on, that they believe they are entitled. And this is not just the FBI. This is all law enforcement and federal intelligence in America. They believe they are entitled to access any information and any possessions and any people that they want to, that they believe they need to get their job done, or that they just think might be a problem or might be relevant to crimes that might happen or might have happened. They believe they are entitled to it all. And they get it most of the time. You know, like I made a quick little blog post about this. Look at everything we've learned from Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA over the last couple of years and everything that's spun out from that. It's very clear, you know, between that and between things that happen at lower levels of law enforcement where they're just, you know, murdering people and getting away with it. It's very clear that the culture of law enforcement in the whole country, from national down to local, is incredibly entitled and just kind of mad. They operate like a lawless military dictatorship where they are entitled to everything they want in their minds, and they usually get it. And even when it's illegal, they do it anyway, and they get away with it most of the time, if not all the time. they get away with it almost all the time. So they are above the law in their minds. They believe they are entitled to everything, and they'll say it's about national security. But you know, that's like the kind of like angry macho neocon craziness. In reality, like this culture that they have is that they are entitled to everything all the time. And whatever they want, they're entitled to do their job, you know, whatever. They think they're entitled to everything, right? And our country so far in recent years, if not ever, in recent years, supports that. We support by what judges say, by what the people do and don't get mad about, by how quickly we all forget things. We, the people and the courts and all the way up to the presidency, everyone in this system is complacent and permits this to happen. So the reality is, it doesn't really matter what's legal here. What matters is what we will tolerate. And they know that. And so that's why they're playing all these emotional buttons. You know, they're talking about the victims and families. And Tim's talking about kids being, you know, everyone knowing the location of your kids. This is why this whole thing just makes me so sad. It really does, because I mean, let's just say that there are reasons I don't usually talk about politics. You know, if you think I'm like negative and bitter about Apple stuff, this is how I feel about politics. So I try to avoid it as a topic for my own happiness and sanity.
I just wanted to make one quick thought, and then I'd like to hear what John has to say about this. But as I was watching this interview tonight, which I think was a little bit unfortunate because, as you had said, or one of you had said, you know, it was the same talking points from both sides, just repeated over and over. I feel like the entire interview could have been like 4.5 minutes long. But anyway, I caught myself sitting there as I'm listening to this, and I thought to myself, this is why we have Tim Cook. You know, this is why Tim Cook is here, is for this very moment right now. Because I don't doubt that maybe Steve Jobs would have fought it the same way Tim is, but I don't know if he would have done as good a job at it. And I am so unbelievably proud of Tim Cook and all of Apple for standing up for what I believe to be right and for doing the right thing, because this is not easy for really either side or anyone involved, but particularly for Apple. And all the credit in the world to Apple. As you said, we have a tendency to call it like we see it, and sometimes we see it to be not so sunny, but I could not be more proud of Apple and Tim Cook than I am right now. John, what do you have to say about all this?
I was thinking about how Steve Jobs might have handled that interview. Like, at the very least, he would have... I mean, Steve Jobs has more sort of natural charisma than Tim Cook. I feel like a lot of the things when you're watching it, if you are supportive of Apple's position in this, the interviewer would ask some leading question to try to, you know, get Tim to say something. And Tim would just go back to his talking points, not falling for the trap. Jobs would have said the things that we're thinking, like the sort of, you know, come back at him and, you know, take more digs at the government and law enforcement. Where Tim was always like, you know, we respect law enforcement, we want to work with them, we want to work together. Jobs would have let the fact that he is pissed be clear that he is pissed at how this is going. You know, Tim Cook got a little bit closer. Now, it's a question whether that would have been actually better in terms of PR, or just, you know, it would have been more satisfying for people who agree with him already. Would it have been any more convincing for people who don't in the court of public opinion? I don't know. So anyway, that's a sideshow. One thing that Marco said that stuck out to me was the idea that this feels worse because Apple can technically do this. And again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know about the legal consequences. But when I think about it, I think that is not relevant at all, because legal question wise is there's two parts to this. One is what Marco alluded to when he said, well, it would be better if they made a system that Apple couldn't break into, because then Apple would just say, well, you know, we can't do anything. Oh, well, sorry, we can't help you. Like, technically, we can't help you. There's nothing we could do. All the money and all the time in the world wouldn't solve this for us. That immediately leads to, okay, we're just going to outlaw cryptography, which is would be a terrible, stupid rule, because you can't outlaw math. And, you know, so whatever. So that's one end of that. But that's what I think this case is about. When I think about it, is just because Apple can do it doesn't mean the government can order them to do it. Like, the government can't make any one of its citizens or corporations or entities or whatever compel them to do something just because they feel like it, right? There has to be established law, as in, when we issue you a search warrant, you have to let us search, right? That's, you know, you can't just say, you know, it would be nice if Apple wrote, you know, a custom operating system to let us crack into this phone. Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? But do you, the government, have the power to compel a corporation to do work for you because you think it would be cool? Like, that's why this is a legal case. Like, this will be decided in the courts and with legislation and so on and so forth. But the idea, like Marco said, that law enforcement, you know, they can technically do this. Why don't we just ask them to? Can't we make them do that? Aren't we, like, in charge here? Like, and the answer is no, you can't really make them. And if Apple doesn't want to, they're going to challenge you, and you're going to have to go through the legal system and try to figure out whether this is something you can even ask them to do. So I always think of it as what I have in the notes here, cryptography versus conscription. Can you conscript a corporation to write software on your behalf if you are law enforcement because you feel like it, not based on any existing law on the books or any legal precedent or whatever, just because it's a thing that's possible? And one of the things I think about, not that this is the same thing at all, but like the idea that individuals and corporations can have rights, the idea that the government can't demand that you testify against yourself. You have the right to remain silent. They cannot compel you to speak against yourself. They may ask you, you know, were you on the date such and such? And if they're accusing you of something, you can just not answer them. And they can't compel you to answer. Because you could answer. Oh, it's much worse because, you know, you have a voice. You could answer them if you want. Why won't you answer the question? They can't compel you to, because it's your right to keep that. And again, this may or may not be speech or whatever. But the whole idea that someone is capable of doing something does not mean, well, if you're capable of doing it, the government should be able to compel you to do it. That doesn't make any sense. So that has to be sorted out in the law. And then conceptually, since we're late to the story and everyone's gone through all the details and we went through a lot of them already anyway, the thing that really boggles my mind about this conceptually is, like, the short view so many people have, like people who are on the wrong side of this issue, as in people who don't agree with me, right? the incredible short view they have, like, just big picture, like, pull back from this issue, pull back from this one phone, pull back from details about, like, how it's been tailor-made to set legal precedent and how, you know, like all the details of the other things wanting to decode stuff and whether you can do it for this one phone and think of the children and the terrorist victims and all this other stuff and the details of whether there's anything on the phone. And you know, also, by the way, the code is probably 111 or 1111 or 1234. They should just try those two codes and they would be unlocked. But even if they did, they would quickly lock it again because that's not what this thing is about.
Yeah, I mean, if also if you're talking about like what's most likely,
there's nothing on the phone.
Yeah, it's way more likely that like that the person's work phone that they had personal phones that they destroyed or were destroyed. It's way more likely the work phone has nothing useful on it. But the FBI knows that, and that's why it isn't about that. It's about, you know, they chose this case to publicize. They chose to publicize it and not do the negotiations in secret where Apple requested. They chose this because they knew that emotionally, that like the will of the people would probably be on their side because they can play the angles of terrorism and victims and everything. Like,
well, that's what I'm getting at, the will of the people, right? So I'd be speaking to the people at this point, the people who don't agree that this is the right thing to do. Just keep pulling back from this case, from this thing, from phones, from encryption, from all the details or whatever, and just think over the last several decades or whatever. The general trend in American government has been people being afraid and looking for anyone who promises to make them safer and giving up rights to get that imagined safety. From 9/11 on, but even before that, the whole idea was that if you scare enough people and say, we can, you know, someone is going to kill you and your family unless we can tap all your telephone calls and read all your mail and do all your communication, like whatever it is, just the general trend. If you put it on a graph, you can argue about specifics or whatever, but there is no arguing that the general trend has been away from civil liberties and towards government has access to more and more stuff. And that has been motivated generally by people being afraid, either people making them afraid or people legitimately being afraid and people taking advantage of that fear to say, now we in law enforcement can do our job better because you're afraid, you need to give us these rights. And time and again, law enforcement and government have proven that once they get the rights, they don't give them back. They use them in the ways that they didn't say that they said they weren't going to use them. They abuse them. There's no repercussions for that. And it's a ratcheting mechanism that never slides the other direction. It only goes to more and more. And technology is enabling to do this. Now, every individual point you can argue with, like, oh, do I agree about this? And what about phone wiretapping? And what about Snowden or whatever? You can argue every individual point. But when you put it on a big graph, this is a massive trend, a massive long-term trend away from civil liberties and towards a loss of individual rights, right? Specifically when it comes to law enforcement, surveillance, and privacy. And so even in this individual case, you just have to, like, you have to color all of your thinking to say, should we just continue to play out this thing on these individual battles, slowly ratcheting our way up? How does this all end? Like, such a long slide. You have to at some point say, there's a limit. You just can't keep asking for more and more and more and generations of people living and dying and just getting used to what the government does until, like, you just can't keep going in that direction forever. It has to be a pendulum. It has to be a cycle. There has to be a swing. And at some point, you have to start swinging in the other direction. At some point, the people, you know, your fear of being killed by terrorists has to be trumped by the, granted, much more intellectual ideas that are, you know, the country is supposedly founded on of, you know, some amount of individual liberty and rights. And again, it doesn't have to swing back all in the other direction. Like, we have freedom of speech, but we also have, you know, slander laws and, you know, can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Like, it's just like the basics of civics 101. There are extremes, and we've been headed in this other direction for so long that I just think that every problem that touches on this issue at all has to be viewed in the context of the humongous, long, clear, unidirectional slide that we've been in for so long. And so anybody who's for this, I have to say, don't think of this individual issue. Do you agree that we've been going this direction for far too long? At what point do we need to turn around? At what point do we need to start swinging in the other direction? I think, personally, we're way past that point. But even if you don't think we're past that point, if you're not thinking about that point, if just every time something comes up that you're afraid of or that you knee-jerk, you know, support the troops, law enforcement is always right, the government is our friend, blah, 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 if every single time something comes up, it's never going to even occur to you to look at where we're going and how we have to swing in the other direction. And I'm far from, you know, a libertarian individual rights nut job type of person. Like, I'm far from that. But I'm just saying, like, no matter where you are, if you never consider, like, this movement, this graph, this spec, then it will never occur to, it'll just, it, and there's no like, oh, it'll be too late. Like, there is no too late. It'll just be the new normal, the new normal, the new normal. The only thing we'll have to compare ourselves with is the rest of the world that is hopefully slightly more sane in these matters, although the UK shows maybe not, because they've got surveillance everywhere too. that things need to eventually swing back in the other direction. And it just seems like anybody who is at this point against this thing is showing that they're thinking entirely with their heart and their fear and all those things, you know, that do them credit in general. But when it comes to establishing legal precedents and giving powers to the government to, you know, rights to privacy. And again, it's all these details. Like, people don't know these details about encryption and all, like, it's too esoteric. It's too, that's why it's the perfect case for the government. It's too, Tim Cook can't make the real case because it's too detailed and your eyes glaze over and you're just like, but terrorists bad, give the government what they want, right? That is exactly the same thing that's got us doing all the crazy things we've been doing since 9/11. And I just feel like you can't continue to go in that direction forever. Everybody should, at the very least, every time they make any argument about it, they should have to explain why not only is this the right thing to do in this case, but I believe that it is essential for us to ratchet this thing up one more notch, you know, for invading our privacy and for giving law enforcement and government more power. In fact, that is essential. And this, because if anyone says it's just this one time or it's just this one thing or whatever, it's like they haven't looked at history, recent history, or ancient history, or any kind of history. That's not the way it works. Once someone gets power, they don't give it up again unless you take it from them.
Yeah, but honestly, I totally agree. First of all, I think everything you just said is gold. But looking at history and looking at the present, you know, and the direction and everything, I don't think I see a lot of evidence that it ever really does swing back into the direction.
Well, you know, America itself was a swing in the other direction. There was more authoritarian government control under a king than there was under a democracy. There was a huge swing in the other direction. Right? It does go back and forth in cycles. Like, if you just study history, there are times where the government has more power over its citizenry and then less power and then more and then less. And, you know, it's clear which direction we're going in now, and it's clear why, and in America anyway. There's no reason we can't reverse that trend. Right? And you would think, like, oh, well, you know, people like being under the king because it provides a measure of safety. And if without a king, like the Mongol hordes would come and kill them or whatever. Like, there's always some reason to be like, yeah, it's terrible, but it's better than the alternative, right? But at some point, people are like, you know, F the king. We're chopping his head off and we're going to have our own system of government or, you know, whatever. Like, we're throwing his tea overboard. Like, those are big, messy calamities. But there are smaller victories as well. I mean, just look at the Constitution. It's been amended many times to give people more rights and take rights away from the government. Say, you know, previously you could own people. Now we think that's not such a great idea. So maybe write that into the Constitution. Or, for the example, you can't drink alcohol anymore. No, never mind, you can. You know, previously we had the right to stop you from drinking alcohol. Then later we said, no, we probably shouldn't have that right.
Yeah, but on the other side of it, like maybe, I mean, first of all, you know, like there's different versions of like a government that has too much power, that's too oppressive, that people revolt against or overthrow. You know, like, granted, this is way out of our usual comfort zone, so please forgive me for anything I'm butchering here. But, you know, like, if you think about, like, the way that we are being oppressed by the surveillance and police states here, it's in a way that most people don't care about because they don't think it affects them. And so it's hard, like, if the government is taxing the crap out of you, you know, like, or taking your land and stuff like that, like, you know, if that's happening to a whole bunch of people, that's enough to make people revolt in most cases historically. But if they're just like, you know, keeping records of your text messages and in these weird secret things that no one really thinks about or knows about, and then even when we're told they exist, everyone's like, yeah, well, it doesn't really matter, and then we all forget and go watch The Bachelor, like, I feel like the ways in which things are going so badly that we're talking about here are ways that people don't care about enough.
Well, they care about them when there are consequences, though.
Well, but for most people, there are no consequences to this that they see.
It doesn't matter if it's not consequences for most people for anything. It just matters that there are consequences for somebody. You need an attractive young person to encounter a problem. You know, like for the same perfect storm that makes these things a great case for the FBI, there's the opposite too, right? And here's the thing that makes me optimistic about it, because in general, despite insane gerrymandering and all sorts of other things, we still have a system where people vote. And so if people get angry enough, the people who are in power get voted out and new people get voted in. So it's always up to someone else to find a way to exploit the public to get them elected. And people are always motivated to do that. And there are smart people trying to get them elected instead of somebody else. And so there'll always be at least some way for us to affect change.
Yeah, but also, like, but over time, you know, as technology has progressed, as the world has gotten more, you know, just more kind of globalized, and you know, as like everything, including manipulation and centralization of power, has progressed. What if oppression by government and by police apparatus? What if this has actually gotten so good that now they're so good and things are so big and there's so much power concentrated in so few hands these days, and the science of manipulating people and manipulating the media and controlling the messaging of everything, that has gotten so advanced. We have gotten so good at, or you know, like the, like at concentrating power basically and keeping those people in power, that that kind of overthrow or change just doesn't happen anymore. You know, like in ways like certain forms of warfare basically don't happen anymore because we as a society have found more effective things, you know, in to cover those needs or wants. You know, certain types of media don't exist anymore. Certain types of legal issues are just not debated anymore. Certain types of freedoms are just assumed that we will either always have or that we will never have. It seems like we've moved forward, we've moved past many of these things, and we've advanced so much that I feel like the police states are so in control now of almost every first world country. And the, so the combination of the establishment of control here, along with these issues usually not bothering most everyday people in ways that they can notice or get mad about, plus the ability for the people who want to keep things this way to very effectively control the media narrative and to have media so centralized that's even possible. I feel like the conditions are such now that that a significant revolution can't really happen anymore. Does that make sense? Am I just crazy?
You're falling into the Illuminati trap where you imagine that it's possible for a conspiracy of people to actually keep their stuff together and actually be all powerful and controlling. Bottom line, people are people. That's what undoes all of these things. Like, if any grand conspiracy theory requires people to be so much more competent than anyone else, so much more intelligent and capable and organized and able to keep secrets and able to, that any conspiracy theory that relies on that is obviously false, because that just does not happen. There are no better set of people better able to control things. And and this is what I was saying before, there may be individual people who are good at that, but they're at opposition to each other. And also all of them are just plain old people with their own stupid foibles and desires and things that don't make any sense. And that the general chaos of people being people means that in the end, not saying it all works itself out, but like I said, as long as you're not in a military dictatorship in which you have to like have a bloody revolution to change things, as long as we still have some way to change things without taking up arms, which at this point would be non-workable anyway, because seriously, the entire United States population versus the entire U.S. Army, if you set up that battle, assuming both sides were highly motivated against each other, which makes no sense because the army is made up of the children of the citizenry or whatever. But anyway, if you can imagine that scenario, we lose every time. Anyway, doesn't matter. As long as voting still functions in some tiny way, which is getting tinier all the time, granted, mm-hmm. but as long as it still works in some way, and as long as people are still stupid people with their own weird desires and motivations, that sort of like dystopian sci-fi narrative where the few rule, the Illuminati rule, and the Morlocks are just like lulled into a sense of, you know, like in many ways Idiocracy is a much more plausible scenario in which everybody's a bunch of dunces. But the idea that
I feel like the reason Idiocracy resonates so much and we use it as such an often metaphor in these circles is because that it, like, the way that I'm picturing there being a big problem for any kind of meaningful progress on these fronts is not the Illuminati situation. It's not a big conspiracy theory. If anything, what we've seen over the last, you know, 10, 20 years or whatever, probably longer, what we've seen is that the government or the those in power can do audacious things, possibly even things that are illegal, and they can just do them right in the open. And if they message it correctly, which they have found more and more effective ways to do over time, as long as it's messaged correctly publicly, they can get away with it almost every time.
But there, there are people who are motivated to get them out of office. Other people want those jobs, and they have the same tools and knowledge at their disposal to battle them. If someone does something like that, it guaranteed when they come up for election and someone wants to run against them, they're going to bring up the thing, and they're going to bring it up in the unfavorable angle using all the tricks of the trade and emotional appeals. Like I think elections, again, not the cure for this, but elections are the hedge against this, because all the tools they have to get away with stuff, people who want them out of office have, you know, to run against them to do the exact same thing.
Yeah, but that's also based on a number of big assumptions of, A, that the population cares what people say in election debates and everything.
But you have to learn how to make them care. That's how you get elected. You have to do all the tricks in the book to get people. I mean, look at Donald Trump. He's using all the tricks in the barrel to get you know, to win the Republican nomination. He's an idiot, right? How is he doing that? Because he knows how to manipulate and play the game, right? Not that I'm saying he's the greatest person, but like, if Donald Trump can, you know, get this close to being president, shows that anybody can. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's the tools are there for everybody. Everyone has access to Twitter. Everyone can be on a reality show where they say you're fired. Everybody can put their face on it. Like, all the tools are there for everybody, and people are constantly hungry to kick out the old guys and bring in the new guys, and they know it's possible because elections happen, and if they can convince you to vote for them, then they get the job, and then they can be corrupt and have power and do stuff or whatever, you know? So, like, again, in sci-fi stories, it's always like, well, or in military dictatorships, or in places like North Korea, where the people have no power, and literally sometimes, or no food, right? Like, it's much harder. But in a first world country, with even a remotely functioning government where people get to vote, there is always hope. And even if it's a hope of, like, get the current terrible people out, and get a different, even more terrible, but terrible in a different way person in, that's still hope. It's not as if, like, it's going to be, you know, a military dictatorship where the supreme ruler passes it on to his son and so on and so forth. And the only way you get out of it is with a bloody revolution or something. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are about it, because I think most of the scenarios where it's like intractable and we're never going to escape from it just don't work out in reality, because people are just people. Like I said,
I hope you're right.
I am. Don't worry. It'll be fine.
I mean, you usually are, so I have some confidence here. You're generally right.
I mean, it's not to say that, like, it can't be disastrous, because I think one of the sci-fi stories and scenarios that is plausible is, like, the one where you get the crazy person, like Trump or something, in there. Or, like, Firestarter. Anyway, don't want to spoil that book for people. Someone like Trump comes in and then, like, nukes somebody and we all die. Like, that's always a possibility. But I feel like I lived through that as a child of the 80s, and now it's like, it's old hat now. The whole world could blow up in any second because of a cowboy in the White House. That's still a possibility. It's still out there, so don't say that that's not going to happen, because it could. But, that again, that could have happened back in the olden days of the 80s just as much as can happen with President Trump and terrorist nuking things or whatever. Terrorist nuking things, by the way, is exactly why they want to be able to monitor every single thing you do. Aren't you afraid of terrorists nuking you? Please let me have access to everything in your entire life, and you have no rights, and we can hold you without trial forever.
Wow. All right, let's talk about something that's happy and awesome, and then I have a question for you guys.
Our final sponsor this week is Harry's. Go to harrys.com and use promo code ATP to save $5 off your first purchase. Harry's offers high-quality razors and blades for a fraction of the price of the big razor brands. They make their own blades from their own factory, an old blade factory in Germany that they liked so much that they bought it, and the prices on these you cannot beat. An 8-pack of blades is just $15. A 16-pack is just $25. You compare that to any comparable blade you find in the drugstore, and it's half the price or less. And I've used these. I'd say they're very competitive in the market. To me, this is the best bargain in the shaving business, bar none. Now, Harry's also has incredibly tasteful designs. Their handles are nice, they're heavy, they're weighty, they're kind of like Mad Men style, but, you know, modern, kind of like a modern throwback. Beautiful designs, beautiful handles. They have great shave cream, great gel if you want that instead. They have a whole lineup. They have face wash, they have aftershave, they have all this great stuff. But really, to me, it's all about the blades and those really nice handles they have. This is, you know, and it's a great website. You go online, you order it, it's delivered right to your door. There's no shopping in, you know, crazy drugstores, getting in the shoplifting cases, anything like that. It's just really nice products delivered right to your door. Check it out today. Go to harrys.com. Now, you can get a starter set that includes a handle, three blades, and shaving cream for just $15. That's a handle with three blades, $15. You cannot beat that. And that's including shipping right to your door. And if you use promo code ATP, you save $5 off your first purchase. So go to harrys.com right now. Get that starter set for $15. Use promo code ATP to save $5 off your first purchase. Thank you very much to Harry's for sponsoring our show.
Real-time follow-up. I'm going to blame this on the cold, which, by the way, I have. Hey, have you heard I have a cold? I have a cold. Not Firestarter. Obviously, the dead zone. Sorry. Brain fart there. And, you know, as Donald Trump would say, he could shield himself from an assassin by holding a young child in front of him and still win the nomination. All right. Enough politics.
Oh, my goodness. God.
Now that I'm sad...
Yeah, seriously.
Is there anything better we can talk about tonight?
Well, I have a question that's related, but maybe less sad, hopefully less sad. Let's assume, well, it's going to start sad, actually. Let's assume that Apple is told, you have to do this. And, you know, the world is upset. We are upset. And actually, we haven't talked that much about how this relates to the rest of the world. But anyway, everyone's upset. Apple's told they have to do this. And Apple says to its engineers, you have to do this now. What happens if all the engineers that work at Apple that have any sort of knowledge as to how to make this happen just say no?
Well, they get fired because it's insubordination.
Do they? I mean, one would assume. I agree.
It's civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is basically like if you refuse to do what the law says you have to do, you accept the consequences of it. Which is either get fired or go to jail. Like, I mean, basically, if Apple's CEOs refuse to comply with the thing, then they're in contempt of court or whatever, you know, thing. And if the people in charge of the company cooperate and tell their subordinates to do it and the subordinates don't, then the subordinates to get fired for insubordination. It's not as if there's some scenario where that we can all sit on their hands and say, well, you told us to do it and I told these guys to do it, but they won't. Oh, well, like court order is a court order and there is consequences for whoever it is that decides to defy it. And you know, they could. Civil disobedience is a way to protest unjust laws. But part of civil disobedience is that you accept the punishment associated with disobeying the laws. And that's part of civil disobedience. So, yes, that could happen. But I really doubt it would.
Right. I mean, yeah, eventually, like, you know, if Tim Cook was thrown in jail over not obeying a final court order, then somebody else would replace him because the company would have to continue operating somehow. And then that person would authorize it, or they'd go to jail, and the next person would. Like, you know, it's like eventually you'd find somebody who would do it. So that's not really a way out.
And really, realistically speaking, they would just do it if they were ordered to. But then simultaneously, what they would be doing is, like Marco said before, they're already obviously, you know, working on an operating system that they themselves can't hack into. And that just leads to the next legal fight, which is, should it be legal to make these things? Which is another incredibly stupid legal fight that, like, at a certain point, law enforcement becomes just so misguided in what they want. Like, in some respects,
I'd say they're already past that point.
I know, but like, when the system is working the way you expect it to, like, law enforcement is highly motivated to get all the powers they possibly can to enforce the law and solve crimes, right? It's checks and balances. That there has to be some opposing force on the other side that says, yeah, law enforcement, you may want this, but civil rights dictate X, Y, and Z. Like, and when the checks and balances get out of balance, then we, you know, that's why you get this long-term trend. And what didn't take much to unbalance it, just giant terrorist attacks on American soil, and then it gets all unbalanced, right?
Can I also make the minor correction that law enforcement's incentive is not to solve crimes, it's to close cases. Not necessarily solving them, just to close the case. Solving them suggests that they're doing it correctly.
In the grand scheme of things, again, people being people, the idea is just to obtain power. But whatever, let's not get into motivations and particular disincentives. But anyway, when things are working, what I'm getting at is that it's not necessarily a bad thing to have two parts of your system of government that are in opposition to each other and both highly motivated and doing everything they can. It's a problem when one side keeps winning for decades on end, because then you get, you know, they're not balancing each other anymore. Like, there is no more balance, right? But in this case, in the crypto thing, like, say Apple's ordered to do it, they do it. 2 years later, they come up with a new version of iOS that they can't even crack into. Eventually, all the old iOS devices would go out of use, so no criminals are using them anymore. And, of course, all the criminals upgraded to the one that Apple can't break into. A similar scenario comes up. Law enforcement has this thing. They want to get into it. Apple can't do it. They're pissed off about it. It becomes a legal issue. You know, the senators and Congress people who think they can best get elected by scaring their citizenry into thinking this needs to be done, they say, it's outrageous that an American company can make phones that the American government can't break into. That should not be allowed. And so they propose legislation that makes cryptography illegal, right? And at that point, you would hope someone in law enforcement would realize that it's asinine, right? America can make whatever it wants illegally. You can't get rid of math. Like, the rest of the world has the math. People can write programs themselves that make cryptography that, in theory, can't be cracked by, you know, the world's biggest computers for some, you know, like, that's, you can't unring that bell. Like, that exists. And so if you make it illegal, for all that's going to do is make law-abiding U.S. companies not do that, but everyone else can do it, right? And it doesn't help law enforcement, right? And practically speaking, criminals, including terrorists, are not as sophisticated as people think they are. But if they wanted to be, like, you know, even this guy's phone, if he had used an alphanumeric password, the government wouldn't, the FBI wouldn't be able to ask Tapple to crack into it anyway because it would take too long, right?
Maybe he did on his personal phone.
Yeah, well, he destroyed that. So anyway, the way the system should work is American companies should be able to make technology they want with the best, you know, cryptography available to them. And the government should be able to spend its hojillions of dollars in tax money to fund, you know, what are they called? Like, not black box budget, but like, you know, budget that you know, there's some word for like secret budgets that you're not even allowed to know how much money they spend, like Homeland Security and the NSA. By all means, give this iPhone to the NSA's experts and have them break into it using huge supercomputers that you built with taxpayer money. Like, if you figure out how to break in, good on you, right? The way, you know, because that is a proper balance where people get to, you know, make better and better cryptography unconstrained by the law, and the government, maybe it's a little bit unbalanced, but the government, with its huge funding, gets to hire the smartest people in the world and build the world's biggest computers to try to crack that cryptography, and yeah, you can have that battle, and that's the way it's worked for, you know, forever in this country, is that the government does have smart people to try to crack things, and people try to make uncrackable things on the outside, and they go back and forth, right? But this is the new strategy of, like, we don't want to do that. It seems hard. Apple, can you just unlock it for us? And so...
Well, because it isn't about this phone. It's about having easier and faster access to any phone they want.
Right. To be able to, I'm the boss of you. I can make you do things.
Yes.
So anyway, if Apple loses this case, Apple will unlock the phone. Then Apple will use its lobbying power and its millions and try to rally the tech companies to try to get legislation to make this, you know, like, it'll be the whole political process. But eventually, Apple will make a phone that they themselves can't crack into. And then that will be a political football where it has to be, who can we try to make this illegal? Maybe that fight will be, you know, like, it's the same. In all these things, you would hope eventually the public will be persuaded that Apple and privacy and cryptography kind of has a point. Even as esoteric as it is, I think eventually it will be understandable enough that, because like the crypto one, you just have to explain to him, look, making this illegal for Apple doesn't do anything. Terrorists can do this right now. You know, it doesn't matter. All it does is mean that it's easier for other people to get into your phone. It doesn't make it any easier for people to get into terrorists' phones, because A, terrorists don't do important things on phones, and B, if they wanted to encrypt things so that no one could get it except for them, they could do it now. They could have done it a decade ago. They have the technology. That's not what's stopping them.
You have a lot more hope than I do for our people and our politicians and our law enforcement. Because everything you just said could apply also to drugs. Like, why make drugs illegal? Then regular people will be penalized for not having drugs, but then everyone else will have drugs. It's like, yeah. And they did it anyway, and it's, look what it's doing. Like, it.
I would make the same big picture argument with the war on drugs, where it's like, regardless of what you may think about an individual issue, what has happened over the past 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in terms of the war on drugs, and what have the results been? What are the intended goals, and what have the actual results been? And maybe pick a different strategy if what you're trying to do is the exact opposite of what you're causing to happen. And that gets into all, you know, puritanical America. That actually does have deep roots in America, the whole idea of, like, finding who to blame or punish versus solving the actual problem. And yeah. This is not a political podcast. Maybe we're going into too many issues. But some things do seem really intractable because of the particular nature of America. We haven't even talked about guns, by the way, which I'm sure we'll get feedback about. Because all those arguments you gave on cryptography, exactly the same arguments you could give for... Anyway, we're not going to talk about guns. Anyway, people have opinions, but this... It's kind of a shame that this is weird and esoteric and techie, because in that way, it probably... Like, Apple could lose this one. Apple is going to lose this one in the court of public opinion. Apple could win it in the legal court, but even if Apple, like, quote-unquote, wins in court, they're going to come out of this as a company that half of America thinks helps terrorists. There's just no avoiding that, which is a shame for Apple. It's a shame for people who don't understand the the larger implications, who don't understand the trend in American life over the past several decades, or who agree with it because they're constantly terrified of everything because they watch Fox News all the time. I don't know. Or any news for that matter. Let's not just call it. I watch MSNBC all the time and all they know is the things that are going to kill them. That's a shame. And that's a bummer for Apple. I mean, that's got to bum Tim Cook out because I think he's a savvy enough person to know that even if he wins, he loses a little bit in this one.
And that's why it's so interesting and admirable if you're on the side of it that they are standing up for this, because the upside for them is not large here.
There is almost no upside for them. Like I don't understand. Like, you could say, oh, the upside is that they can sell more people phones. Like Marco said, people don't care enough about this.
No.
I'm going to buy the Apple phone because it's less likely the government's going to. No one thinks about that. Like, there's barely any upside for that. It is a net loss for Apple no matter how this turns out, I feel like.
Absolutely. It's a huge loss. And, I mean, the silver lining I can see in this, the only silver lining I can really see in this, is that Apple is no stranger to bad press, you know, and to negativity about them and you know, rumors or slight mistruths or even truths that are about them that just suck being spread in the media very quickly and basically sticking around forever. You know, any kind of iPhone flaw or like the quitting your apps thing, even, or like the idea that they're like that they changed the dock port to the Lightning port to make you rebuy all your cables.
Don't get me started.
Like, there's so, like negativity about Apple spreads so much in the general population now that, you know, this is not new for Apple. This won't be the only negative thing about them that a lot of people truly or falsely believe. And the other thing is that might help them here is part of what makes it so hard for things like the Snowden revelations to really stick around in the news cycle, that people will move on. You know, like next week, Kanye West will say something and that'll be and then all this won't matter anymore. It's like the attention span of the hot topic in American news is so short. Especially for something like this where, you know, like the Snowden stuff, where it's kind of complicated and there's no good solution or end game here that's going to happen. And just understanding the topic in general is complicated. Like, I've had a number of non-geeks bring up this topic in the last week or so since it came out. And every time, their reaction is not, what is Apple doing to help terrorists? It's what exactly is going on here, because it's a hard topic to understand if you aren't very technical and also haven't like read a really good summary of it. You know, it's all very sensationalized and very, you know, very like being boosted by the media here and there. But nobody really, like, in general, people don't really understand it or don't have a very accurate picture of it. So honestly, I don't think it's going to stick around for very long in the news cycle. I think. I'd be surprised if anybody was talking about it 2 weeks from now.
To give some support for your pessimism, Marco, by the way. Like, if you think about for issues like this that are technical, that people don't really care that much about, that you need to kind of be into the intellectual or legal side of it to really have it hold your attention because it's too complicated to think about otherwise, very often leads to terrible laws that take a long time, if ever, to go away. It doesn't mean they'll never go away. It just means that we may all be dead. Some recent examples are like the DMCA, all of the weird, stuff involving cable television and breaking encryption on ink cartridges for printers, and like all the laws. Most of those are done by corporate lobbying, obviously, but laws that are about technical issues. Like I really feel like if you took any individual American and put them into a room and explain the DMCA and the actual consequences of it, they would come down on the side that this is a stupid law. They would understand the motivations, but this is not the way to do it because it can be abused in all these ways and look at how it works and blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is that passed. It's still the law of land. It's not going away anytime soon. Eternal copyright, another great example. You can explain some of that until you're blue in the face. You could probably convince pretty much everybody individually. But overall, people are like, yeah. I don't know, whatever. They should own Mickey Mouse, I guess. Like, no one thinks about the long-term consequences of copyright without end or any, like, outlawing encryption is the one I'm thinking.
The entire patent system.
Yeah, the entire patent system, like, outlawing encryption. Could they outlaw encryption despite how stupid it is? Like, I'm hoping that law enforcement realize that outlawing encryption is pointless and they wouldn't even pursue it. But if they did pursue it, they'd get it. Because
law enforcement is not a culture of trying to understand things.
It's not a culture. It's just like some things are, you know, like you need people, sort of subject matter experts thinking about the consequences, and then also pair them with people who are good at convincing other people to do what they say. And that's how you get good law. It's really easy to get bad laws. And we have lots of examples for bad laws. You're just hoping that, like, and like what I'm getting at is that your pessimism is not that this is like a, you know, a one-way slide into doom. It's just that some of these things take a really, really long time to turn around. Long enough that, you know, we won't live to see them. Like, do you think we'll ever live to see the DMCA taken away? No, probably not. Do you think we'll ever live to see reasonable copyright or patent law? Certainly not, right? But it doesn't mean those things are hopeless and they will never swing back in the other direction, because all you need, because people are so fickle and have short attention spans and can't be into the intellectual details of every single freaking thing that the government does, the system is always ripe for a small group of smart people to capitalize on a crisis in a way to make something good happen instead of something bad. And that is always a possibility in any sort of democracy. And so that's why I think long term, we'll never get to the really cool dystopias in the sci-fi movies, because what I always think about when I watch those movies is like, that's fine, but long term, like, I mean, even though you have the rise of Hitler, right, eventually people realize we should fight this guy, right? And it's like, you'll never have something like that. That would be a fantasy. Well, what about Hitler? He was pretty terrible. He was, you're right, but it didn't lead to, and it's Hitler forever. Like, you know, people die, people are killed, people fight. Like, again, we could all nuke ourselves, and that makes it, that's the only sci-fi I believe, where everybody's nukes. Like, yeah, that could happen, and then, you know, the machines take over, I guess. I don't know. But the ones where it's just, like, a bunch of people who sort of, like, boil the frog, and they slowly, like, find themselves in increasingly dire situations, and they can't get themselves out of it, and then you just fast forward, like, thousands of years, and it never gets any better, that just doesn't seem plausible to me, because in the end, people are people. They don't want to be uncomfortable. They don't want to, you know, be sad or hurt. They want to just hang out, and the holodeck would kill everybody. We all know that. But aside from that, we're fine.
I'm too depressed to even make an infinite time scale joke.
You don't need an infinite time scale for holodeck. You need a holodeck, and that's it. End of humanity. Sorry, everybody.
Oh, my goodness.
On that happy note, I think we're out of time tonight. Do you want to give some other topic anyway, just to not end on that, even though we'll go over time? I don't care.
We can do it in the post show.
Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week, Squarespace, Fracture, and Harry's, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over, they didn't even mean to begin, cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research, Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
All right, so what do you want to talk about then? What's happy these days?
Anything else besides this?
I want to save my Blu-ray thing for a happier, a more tech-heavy week when we come out of this politics show and swear never to talk about it. It's you know what? It's Apple's fault, right? It's not like we choose. It's like the car thing. It's like Apple building a car. We had a car podcast, and now we have a tech podcast. And then Apple decides they're going to make a car, maybe, allegedly, possibly. That's not on us. It's not like you say, you just wanted to talk about cars again. I'm not making there be rumors about Apple making a car. And similarly, we don't want to talk about politics on the show. We avoid it as much as we can. But then Apple, the main tech company that we talk about on the show, has to get into a big fight in the government on a political issue. What can we do? Like, it had to happen. And it's very difficult to talk about political issues without getting political. So if you're angry that we talk about in the politics in the show, and you're thinking of sending us an email or tweet that tells us we should stick to technology, we were. Blame Apple. Blame the government. This is a technology-related issue, 100%.
So was that the happy topic?
No, that's just like the preemptive whining.
At this point, I feel like we should just pull the ripcord and be done.
Oh my god, I don't even want to talk about the Mac Pro.
Is there news?
I'm not gonna bite. I'm not gonna bite.
All right, I wanted to know if there was news, but if there's no news, that's fine.
Of course, always assume there's no news about the Mac Pro, because almost all the time, with the exception of Phil Schiller's app innovation, every other time there's no news about the Mac Pro.
Oh, there was the repair thing where everyone's Mac Pros that were like failing, they have like a repair extension program to help them, right? Oh,
god damn it.
That wasn't this week though.
I know, it was semi-recent, but I feel bad for Mike because he sold his because it was flaky, but if he had kept it a little bit longer, he could have got it, you know, all new guts that presumably don't suffer from whatever weird problems he was having.
Yeah, but the iMac was a better computer for him anyway.
I thought it was just, it's great for putting your iPad in front of. It's a nice backdrop. He puts a screensaver on it so he can look at it while he uses his iPad in front of it.
Oh, iPad people. We can talk about them. They have good news. They have the pencil news, this thing.
We didn't mention that.
Yeah, with the 9.3, the 9.3 beta, all the betas up till now had removed the ability to use the Apple Pencil to do certain UI tasks like scrolling lists and panning things. And our friends noted that over the last few weeks and months as 9.3 has been in beta. And then we heard from a few people, I think including ATP Tipster, that this was actually not a bug. This was actually a choice Apple had made that the pencil shouldn't be used for these things. And then over the last few days, a whole bunch of people wrote articles about it. And last week or 2 weeks ago, Cortex complained about it very effectively. And so there was a whole bunch of complaining about it over the last couple of weeks. And then Apple announced yesterday, I believe, that... they gave a wonderfully spun PR statement to the effect of, oh, we always plan to do it this way, and next beta it'll be back. It was just temporarily removed, you know. And of course it wasn't, and of course that was PR spin. But it's fine.
Well, see, I don't know. Like, I don't know if to take that at face value, because the thing, again, this is the more open Apple, which is nice that they're telling us. Like, in the old Apple wouldn't tell us at all. Like, we would, you know, be under NDA, and developers would just...
Well, they told us something.
I mean, baby steps, right? But the real thing is, what I've always been thinking of is, like, what would be the motivation for removing this functionality? I think Stephen F. on Twitter had a couple of speculation about what it might be, but he was wrong. I'm thinking, like, why would they remove it? Like, assume it's intentional, right? And assume they're not telling you this is intentional because they don't want to. I'm just trying to think of a plausible reason for them to intentionally remove it. Like, I can't come up with anything.
The best reasons I heard were... One was the idea that you could be like scrolling things with your finger, but that you should only be using the pencil to like tap or make marks on things and to kind of clarify what the pencil is used for. But like, you know, people aren't idiots. They know what the pencil is for. Like, so I think that's not a great reason. The other reason I heard that was more, I think, more likely and more credible was simply that Apple didn't want to... They didn't want people to get into the habit of not using touch as the primary interface to iOS in general, to the overall UI and overall usage of these devices. They wanted the primary interface to remain touch, and they didn't want anybody like making apps that had a bunch of tiny touch targets, and they didn't want people to be using the pencil full time. But the reality is that is not also a good enough reason. Like, that's, first of all, like, if people make apps with a bunch of tiny touch targets, who cares? If that's truly not what most people are doing, those apps won't succeed. The market will solve that problem.
That's such a bad reason that I like to think that it wasn't there. But here, say
but,
say that
but
was
but that
the
is
reason.
A modern Apple reason.
Right. So say that was the reason. What I would like to see is for Apple to say that. Like, why can't that debate ever happen in public? This is like a half debate where they passive aggressively do something, don't tell you why. People complain and then they reverse it and never told you why they were going to do it in the first place. Instead of like the first beta comes out with it. News sites realize that this is the thing. They write stories about it, and that there's a public dialogue where Apple immediately says, oh, no, guys, you don't understand. Here's why we did this. We did it because we don't want people making apps with touch targets. Well, at least then you can have a real debate about like the merits of the issue, as opposed to now where the debate happens entirely internally, and it's just a one-sided thing where people complain outside, and maybe you're screaming into a void, or maybe Apple is listening. Did you convince them? Or maybe they're going to say it was an accident? Like, this whole black box thing where you don't know. Like, not that we need to be privy to everything that's going on there, but I just think it would behoove everyone in this relation, in this dysfunctional relationship between customer and corporation, to speak openly with each other, to believe enough in each other for Apple to tell us the real reason they want to make a functional change in the OS. And then we can talk about the reasons why we think that's dumb, or, you know, like, instead of just saying, we can't tell if this is a mistake or not, but God, if this is intentional, please don't do it, because maybe Apple can convince us. Maybe they have a really good reason that we haven't thought of, right? Or maybe, you know, their reason has to do with unreleased product that we don't know about and they can't tell us. I understand this is always going to be a limited situation here. I just feel like it would be a healthier feedback loop between customer and corporation. Not that either one has entire rights to know what the other one is thinking all the time, but I think we need to get closer to a relationship where people like Marco don't assume that everything Apple says is a lie, because they're not going to reveal their real reasoning.
Well, I didn't say that. I just think the PR statement was pretty clearly BS, but it doesn't really matter.
I don't know. You're just assuming it is, but like, because the reason sounds so dumb to you, but then you don't know what to think. Do you think, like, are they being disingenuous? Why would they hide it? Especially since they've changed their mind. Wouldn't you come out and say, we were originally doing it for reason X, but now we're convinced? Because that would be the truth then. The truth would be, we had this reason. People complained. We were convinced by their complaints that our reasons don't trump their desires. Therefore, we changed our mind. Like, that's a healthy dialogue. Instead of, if, you know, again, if what you're saying is true, instead of pretending that that wasn't really the case and, oh, we were always meant to do this, right? Assuming they're pretending. It just seems like a dysfunctional relationship.
Yeah, I don't know. At least it's fixed. You know, like, whenever people in our parts make big complaints about a change Apple is floating in a beta, we always hear from people. I always see people responding, or they respond to me if I'm one of the critics, of like, why do you bother doing this? You're complaining about Apple. But the reason we bother doing it is because it works, because then these things do tend to get fixed.
Well, it's random reward. It works sometimes. It works randomly. You know, like, if it worked every time, it wouldn't be as motivating to do it. And if it worked never, we would never do it. But it works enough of the time.
Well, I think, you know, like, these kind of decisions, these are probably debated inside Apple, right? Almost every decision that like, we get mad about, chances are people inside Apple were also mad about them and they argued about them. And so when outsiders pile onto the argument or draw attention to the argument, that helps that side in the inside Apple win the argument, or it helps change people's minds. So it is very effective. And it, again, you're not going to win every time, because, like, if you're trying to argue for something like, well, you know what, I'm tired of app review, there shouldn't be app review. Like, well, you know, you're not going to win that. That's unlikely.
You can keep arguing that, because someday that will be on the table.
On an infinite time scale.
It'll be on the table again.
Yes. I got it.
Well, and another example is you could complain about the file system for, I don't know, a decade.
All right. We feel better now.
And then, you know, maybe eventually they'll come around. But yeah, no, I mean, it's the function of the tech press. Like, I mean, this is happening whether Apple admits it or not. Of course, it's always been happening, because Apple's made up of people and they read tech press about themselves, because, you know, that's the way it works. And as you pointed out, there's always dissension within the company. But in the end, certain people are in charge and certain people aren't. And Apple's not a democracy, and neither is the press, and neither is anything else. But what we're just trying to get is a healthier symbiosis, where Apple's potential customers are telling it what they would want, and Apple wants to give customers what they want, but maybe not those customers. Maybe they see other customers who they're not currently talking to, or they're it's not as if customers should be in charge of Apple, and it's not as if Apple should be in charge of the customers. It's just and it's opening up. Like, I feel like the dialogue is opening up more than it used to be, and this is healthy. We just have a ways to go yet.
Do you guys use the iPad Pro, Marco?
Are you talking about me and John or me and Tiff?
You and Tiff.
Oh, she uses it. She uses it tonight. And she uses the Pencil to navigate a bunch of stuff. Hmm. And if I use the iPad Pro or any iPad on a regular basis, I would certainly consider doing the same thing, because I like the Pencil a lot. As an input device, it is really nice. And there's all sorts of arguments other people have made about it being either more efficient or better for advanced work or better for ergonomics or better for accessibility for certain people.
Or it just feels better. The mic argument is sometimes it just feels better.
Exactly. If I were an iPad user, or if I was the kind of person who liked writing things with pens and pencils, I would certainly be using it all the time. But neither of those things apply to me, unfortunately, so it's not really for me. But I do respect it a lot as a really nice input device.
I do wonder a little bit, though, like, in these type of feedback cycles and relationships, that part of the reason the old Apple would not do something like this is because it was seen as like a sign of weakness, like, oh, we weren't right, we were wrong about something, we need to change it. But part of it is also that it is legitimately, like, taking taking the angry feedback from your most enthusiastic users as a way to design your products is a formula for death. Like, Apple doesn't do that for a good reason. You never want to, like, just listen to your most enthusiastic users, because you will evolve your product in a way that caters more and more to, like, the expert, the super enthusiast, and you'll never get something like the iPhone, because the super Apple enthusiasts were, like, drawing pictures of, like, OS 10 on a phone or something. You know what I mean? Like, Apple doesn't do that, to its credit. It knows the trap of, or Microsoft has done it so many ways, you keep adding features because your experts want features and you go to your experts or whatever. But for the iPad Pro, it's kind of a sign that Apple realizes that at this point in the iPad Pro's history, that fanatical group of users who really love the thing, that's all they've got at this point. Like, if they're going to betray those people for some larger market, that they don't have faith that that will materialize. So they better listen to the most passionate iPad Pro users, because there aren't many iPad Pro users, presumably, and it is kind of a high-end enthusiast product. Like, there's a whole other line of iPads for the rest of the world and phones for the rest of the world. But for the iPad Pro, now, if you're going to listen to anybody about anything, like, that's where you would do it. On the other hand, if the iPad Pro was burning up the sales chart and everybody was buying one, and it was, like, taking over for the Mac, and Mac sales are going to be down 50%, and iPad Pro sales were going to be, like, half the iPhone sales next year, they would feel confident to ignore those people and say it's more important to go with our gut instinct of whatever their internal reasoning is. So, in some ways, it gives me a view of how Apple sees the current state of the iPad Pro market. They're not in a position right now to just do what they want, despite the howls of enthusiasts, whereas on many other markets, for example, the iPhone, people howling to be able to sideload apps, Apple confidently ignored them as the sales graph for iPhones went, you know, up like a ski jump. And that's, they were in a position of strength there, but on the iPad Pro, not right now.
Yeah. And as much as it sucks for Apple to be, like, losing things, as much as it sucks for them, I like what comes out of them when they have, like, a fire lit under them. You know, like, I like when they're not in a dominant position, when they're fighting really hard. That tends to be when the best stuff comes out of them.
Except for TV boxes. Sorry, low blow. So much competition in that market. That's a different topic.
Honestly, have you used it?
That's my Blu-ray top. I know. I'm just saying.
I also thought there was so much competition that was really good until I tried to use the competition.
Well, there's a lot of competition. It's just not really good.
Yeah, that's fair.
Is that a fire lit under them, or is it just like tepid water dripping on their toes? I don't know.
It's called fire, but yeah, it doesn't really work that way. I'd like to set it on fire.